Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. This is the final episode in our presentation of this year's Spokesman Review Summer Stories. If you missed one, you can listen back to all 8 episodes on The Bookshelf podcast or at SpokanePublicRadio.org. This year's theme was Mount St. Helens, and the Spokesman Review newspaper published 17 short stories by local authors on that theme. Tonight, we'll hear 2 of those stories, the first of which is by Dan Gemeinhardt. He's the author of 5 books for younger readers, the most recent being The Remarkable Journey of Coyote Sunrise. Gemeinhardt is a Gonzaga University graduate who worked for 13 years as an elementary school librarian and teacher. He lives in Kashmir with his family. Here's Dan Gemeinhardt reading his story, Hope.
Hope, by Dan Gemeinhardt. As a matter of fact, I never wanted to kill my neighbor's cat. But sometimes things happen, and sometimes one thing leads to another, and sometimes you're just kind of swept along in a landslide, and then all of a sudden you're trying to hide a dead cat. It happens. It all started like 3 days ago, when the ash started falling. I'd just blown up at my mom. The explosion was a long time coming, I guess, building up inside me, hot. If she could have seen me, I bet my face would have been white and splotchy like it gets when I'm mad, my eyes lightning bolts. But she couldn't see me, of course. She never can. Not unless they invent a telephone that lets you see who you're talking to, and that ain't likely. When she told me she wasn't coming to see me again, I just erupted. "Of course you ain't," I shouted. "You never do. You ain't come to see me since you left." Which is true, as a matter of fact. She's always promising to come and visit, but she never does, and she never has, not in the 3 months since she walked out. I just got tired of it, I guess. I yelled some other words that ain't generally considered polite, and then hung up hard enough that my hand kind of hurt. I ain't never yelled at Mom before, never hung up on her neither. But heck, sometimes when something's pent up for too long, it comes out hot and loud. And then, watch out. Dad hollered from the bedroom, "Hey! What was that all about? That ain't no way for a 10-year-old girl to talk." "None of your business," I shouted back. "And as a matter of fact, I'm 11. Dad thought about that for a second. I knew he was scowling, like he always does when it's pointed out that he ain't that smart, which is pretty often. "Well," he said sulkily, "it ain't no way for any kid to talk." I glared at the ashtray, sitting there on the kitchen table next to the phone. I won't let Dad get rid of it, even though he don't smoke. Mom's the smoker, and someday she's coming back. I made it myself in school, fired in the kiln and everything. It's kind of lumpy and wobbly, a crooked circle covered with what's supposed to be polka dots, but really just look like stains. It's empty now, but before she left, it always made me proud to look and see it full of ash and butts. When I think of her, it's that burnt smell of cigarettes that's strongest in my mind, and the sound of her singing. I hated it back then, but I miss it now.
"You okay?"
Dad called. He knew who I'd been talking to.
"Just peachy," I answered, then slammed out the back door onto our deck.
Deck is probably a generous term. Our trailer is only a single wide, but it's setting at the top of a slope, so Dad and his brothers built a deck off the back of it. It's pretty close to sturdy. I stomped out and leaned over the rail. 10 feet below was the yard and the round, domed lid of our barbecue. Past that, a bunch of bushes and trees, and then the Spokane River, gliding along quiet. It was so cloudy it was almost dark, which was weird, because it had been sunny all morning. 10 years old, I muttered, then spit and watched it drop down to the ground. Dad is a piece of work, and sometimes work is the nicest word I'd use to finish that description. He was too young when they had me, everyone says that. He does his best, everyone says that, too. Maybe it's just that his best ain't all that great. But heck, maybe him being a dad is like me doing fractions. We got to get some credit just for showing up. I hear footsteps creak up behind me, and I know it's Dad showing up. "She ain't coming, huh?" he says, and I just spit again. "Maybe she'll make it next weekend." I just snort and rub at my eyes. "Yeah, probably not. But you can hope, I guess." Hope, shoot. "Hope is the thing with feathers," I say.
"What?"
I shrug. "It's something Carol said." Carol's our neighbor. She thinks she's some sort of an artist, but I think she's some sort of a weirdo.
It's from a poem, I think, by some lady. Huh, Dad says, and I agree. Carol said it like it was all meaningful or something, and I kind of smiled, but really I was like, I don't know, that sounds pretty darn vague. Still, the words got kind of stuck inside me. Well, don't get all crabby about it. And then he goes back inside. Jesus. He means well, I guess, but I ain't taking advice from a guy who can finish 3 cans of Rainier during 1 episode of MASH. It seemed like it was getting darker and darker. My eyes were burning. I looked at the birds sitting in the trees. Mom loved the birds. We got 2 feeders nailed to the deck railing, but they were both empty as the ashtray inside. It's like everywhere I looked, I saw the emptiness Mom left behind. Then it started to fall. I blinked, trying to make sense of it. Little floating bits of white and gray. Saw some land on my sleeve. I bent to look, but my breath blew them away. More fell, though, and then more. Soon it was everywhere. Dad came out with me, and we watched it fall. Ash. Ash, ash, everywhere. We turned on the radio and heard about that volcano way over there. The birds were still and silent in the trees, the goldfinches flashing bright like gold dust in muddy water. We probably shouldn't be breathing this, Dad said, but we both still stood there and watched. What'll the birds eat? I asked. Whatever they normally do, Dad shrugged. It's just ash. Their food ain't going nowhere. But I frowned, looked at the feeders. Empty, in a gray world. Why would something pretty as a goldfinch ever come back to an empty feeder? I went to the garage and found Mom's big tub of birdseed, and I filled the feeders up. Mom called again that night, but I wouldn't talk to her. School was canceled because of the ash. As a matter of fact, school being canceled ain't all that fun when you can't go outside and you ain't got an Atari. Who'd have thought we'd ever get stuck at home, schools closed, and have to wear a mask to go to the store? So I spent most of my days watching the birds coming back to the feeder, singing their songs. Puffs of ash when they landed on a branch. We left the ash on the back deck. I didn't let Dad sweep it off like most people did. I liked how it looked like snow. I could see my footprints from when I refilled the feeders, and the tiny 3-toed tracks to the birds where they landed. I could see where things left from, and where they came back to. I liked it. It was on the second day I found the dead goldfinch. Lying on the deck, bright and still. I thought the ash had killed it somehow, but then I saw him over on the stairs leading down to the yard. Paw prints in the ash, leading straight over to Carol's house. Ginger, I hissed, glaring at the prints. Ginger is orange and white, with green eyes and a swishing tail. The next day I found 2 more, a chickadee, black and white and precious, and another goldfinch. The birds were wary now, watching the feeders from the trees but staying away. When Mom called that night, Dad talked to her for a long time, but I wouldn't take the phone. I was still red hot. On the 3rd morning, I found another body, lifeless in the ash, a little white and brown thing, eyes closed. And then that afternoon, slouched at the table, back door standing open to let in a breeze, going crazy from being locked all alone for 3 days, my heart boiling up inside me, rumbling. A couple birds were braving the feeders. Then Ginger, creeping up quiet behind the empty flower pots, paws silent on the ash, eyes electric. I sat up. She got right under the feeder, looking up. I jumped to my feet at the same time she leapt up at the feeder, claws spread wide to snare a thing with feathers. I didn't waste any time thinking, my anger exploding out of me. Ginger landed on the deck rail, a goldfinch struggling in her claws. I grabbed that crappy clay ashtray off the table and roared and chucked it through the door, hard as I could. Ginger flashed her head to me at the last second, ears back. The ashtray thunked off her skull, and her body crumpled limp. She tumbled over the rail and out of sight. The loud, echoing dong of her hitting something. I stood there, frozen. Crap, I whispered. I waited for the sound of her running away. But there was silence. I tiptoed out and peeked over the deck's edge. There was Ginger, still as a statue, a cloud of ash swirling in the air around her. They say cats always land on their feet. As a matter of fact, sometimes they land on their back on a barbecue and stay there, apparently. I gulped and ran down and approached her slow, but I knew she wasn't breathing, and her back wasn't in the shape you'd hope to see if you were rooting for her to live. 9 lives my foot. I suppose there were two or three ways Ginger might have died in that fall, though, so I guess she'd already spent six or seven by the time she went after that bird. I sighed, looking at her twisted corpse. It was a heck of a throw, but I wasn't proud of killing her. Now there'd be an empty dish at Carol's house, an empty spot on the windowsill. That's what happens when things blow up, I guess. They leave quiet and emptiness and ash. I buried her out under the trees, had to carry her down there under my shirt in case Carol was looking. It was gross. She was still warm. I looked down at the little mound covering her up down by the water, thought of the birds unburied. "Rest in peace, murderer," I said. Back on the deck, I scraped the ash off the slats with my feet, erasing Ginger's tracks, refilled the bird feeders. My little eruption had killed, but it had cleared the way. The birds could come back. Maybe that's also what happens when things blow up. They make room for a return. I could hear Dad talking inside, on the phone.
"Yeah, they're saying like 50 dead or something. Quite a deal."
51, I thought, counting cats.
"Well, anyways," he says, "this weekend, you promise? Like, you really promise?"
I hold my breath. Something flutters in my heart. It's a new thing.
"Okay, I'll see you then."
My eyes burn, and it ain't from the ash. The thing inside me stretches its wings. It's gold and fragile, this thing inside me. It's got feathers, I think. As a matter of fact, it might be hope.
You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. That was Dan Gemeinhardt reading his short story, Hope, which was published as part of this year's Spokesman Review Summer Stories, a special feature in the Sunday newspaper for each of the last seven summers. A highlight of the Summer Stories series every year is a story by Spokane author Jess Walter. He's the author of the New York Times best-selling novel, Beautiful Ruins, as well as The Zero, a finalist for the National Book Award, Citizen Vince, which won the Edgar Allan Poe Award, and three other novels. His story collection, We Live in Water, was released in 2013, and his newest book, The Cold Millions, will be released on October 27th. A former reporter for the Spokesman Review, Walter lives in Spokane with his family. Here's Jess Walter reading his story, What Rises Beneath.
What Rises Beneath, Jess Walter. It was quiet for 140 years. Then the mountain began to rumble again. Earthquakes and bursts of steam, blue flame and ash clouds that sparked 2-mile bolts of lightning. All that spring, the volcano seethed and spewed and shuddered, magma bubbling up its throat and pushing the north flank out 5 feet a day. 5 feet, like a new human being every day. That's what was happening to us, too. On April 24th, 1980, seething, spewing, shuddering, my sister Tanya and I found out that a new human being was joining our family. "Wait," Tanya said. "What? You're having a baby?" I stared at Mom's flat stomach. "No," Mom took a deep breath. "You have a 12-year-old brother. His name is Patrick. He's coming to live with us." Tanya and I stared at each other. "But Tony is 12," said Tanya. This was a good point. I was 12. Tanya was 15. "Wait," Tanya said, "Tony has a twin?" "No, Tony does not have a..." Mom's face went red, and she muffled a swear word. "You know what? I'm going to let the son of a bitch explain it himself." Then she stormed out of the room, trailing blue flame and 2-mile bolts of lightning. The son of a bitch was my dad. He was a chemist who worked for a grass and seed company, and when he got home from work that afternoon, he took off his wire-rimmed glasses and sat sweating in front of my sister and me. "Several years ago," the sweating son of a bitch said, "your mother and I were having difficulties. This was right before we found out your mother was pregnant with Tony, and we reconciled. Now, occasionally, when adults have difficulties, they seek out the comfort of, well, other adults." "Oh, God," Tanya said. Dad cleared his throat and looked at me. Tony, I'm trying to remember how far you and I got in our discussion of procreation last month. I held up my left hand in an okay sign, took my right index finger, and put it through the circle, simulating, right, the son of a bitch said, that far. I'm going to puke now, Tanya said, and went to her bedroom. The son of a bitch and I stared at each other. It was quiet for 140 years. Is he taller than me? I asked finally. He wasn't. He didn't even make it to the shoulder of the social worker who brought him to our house that night. He reminded me of a feral cat with an unruly thicket of black hair and nervous dark eyes. He had a jagged mix of baby teeth and permanent ones in rows like a shark's mouth. He arrived with only the clothes on his back, Oshkosh jeans, moon boots, gray t-shirt. He wouldn't let go of the social worker's hand. Mom made up the sofa bed in the basement, then went through my old clothes and made a pile for him. That's what got me, seeing this creature wearing my clothes. I'd wake up every morning and go to the kitchen for breakfast, and there would be Patrick eating the last bowl of Fruit Loops in my old jeans and my white Ocean Pacific t-shirt, the one with the surfer on it. That's my favorite shirt, I objected. You haven't worn that shirt in a year, Mom said. Yeah, because it's so special. Patrick wore the shirt every other day. He loved it. And my old Mattel handheld basketball one game, which Mom had also given him. I got basketball too for Christmas, so technically I didn't play the old one much. But still, I said to Mom. Tony, I know this is hard, she said. It's an adjustment for all of us. We all have to make sacrifices. From what I could see, the only one making sacrifices was me. Tanya mostly ignored the basement creature. When she did notice him, it was with the look you'd give a slug that has crawled up and suddenly started speaking Spanish. What? And gross. Mom fed and clothed the creature, took him to the doctor and the dentist, and the creature liked her the most. He met her eyes and actually talked to her. The rest of us, he'd mumble, mm-hmm, if he meant yes, mm-mm, if he meant no. But he'd look up shyly at Mom and say, almost in a whisper, can I have more green beans? The creature was stealing my mom. Dad, too. The son of a bitch took Patrick for a haircut and on Saturday took him for walks. I knew all about those walks because he used to take me. In between puffs of his pipe, he'd ask about school or tell me about sick stuff like procreation. He'd also point out sciencey things like crabgrass in the Bailey's lawn or how fruit trees pollinated. They were the most boring walks ever. And now I miss them. Mom could tell I was upset because she spoke quietly to Dad, and the next Saturday he showed up in my bedroom doorway with his pipe in his teeth. Feel like a walk, champ? Mm-mm, I said, and went back to playing basketball too. When you're a kid, your family is the basic underlying equation of the whole world, a physical and mathematical constant. Two adults plus two kids equals one family. Subset, house, garage door, dog, hit by car, replaced by dog with same name, father home from work at 5:15 p.m., dinner on the table at 6, visit grandparents every other Sunday, presents opened Christmas Day, duh. It had been this way since the dawn of time, you figure, the bedrock upon which the world is built. What you don't know is what rises beneath that bedrock, that your father has been out procreating with strangers, sticking his index finger in their okay signs, that your mother will rifle through your best things and give them to some basement creature, that your parents will one day bring home a replacement for you. The world is shattered. What permanence, what normality. Life is fragile, random, dangerous. At school, Patrick was a grade behind me, in sixth grade while I was in seventh. So that meant he was still in elementary school and I was in junior high. That was good, although we still had to take the bus together. This was how the last straw happened. It was early May and we were walking to the bus stop together, Patrick a few feet behind me. It had just rained, and I looked back to see that he was stepping in mud and looking down at the patterns the soles of his shoes made, just like I used to do. I looked at his shoes, my old waffle stompers. The creature was stomping mud waffles in my favorite shoes. Sure, I'd outgrown them, but I still loved them. Not liked, loved. and no one had asked if the creature could have them. I stopped, stared at the shoes. Last straw. Superheroes aren't the only ones with origin stories. Supervillains have them too, and this was mine. Given to me, I said. Without a word, Patrick sat in the mud, untied the shoes, and handed them to me. He walked to the bus stop that way, got on the bus, went to school, and eventually came home. I assumed he went about his whole day in wet, squishy socks, and I was glad. 2 weeks later, Mount St. Helens erupted. 57 people killed, 250 homes, 47 bridges, and 185 miles of highway destroyed. The entire north side of the mountain collapsed, dissolving into the lake beneath it, the largest landslide in recorded history, followed by a 9-hour explosion of earth and cinders, a massive cloud of smoke, stone, and debris rising 80,000 feet into the air and dumping ash across 11 states and parts of Canada. We lived 300 miles from the volcano in the Spokane Valley. That afternoon, I remember being on my bike and seeing a massive black cloud approaching, like the end of the world. I remember Mom yelling, "Get in the house!" Then all went dark and ash began raining down. It fell like a dusty gray snow over everything. Ash clogged the sewers and choked car engines and closed the airport. We didn't know if it was toxic, so we had to stay indoors for a couple of weeks and wear masks whenever we went out. We were trapped, everything canceled, schools, businesses, sports. Of course, I think about this now, in the spring of 2020, as my family shelters in place because of the coronavirus pandemic. My daughters are already sick of each other. They are 16, 13, and 10, not far from the ages of Tanya, Patrick, and me when the volcano erupted. "Look," I tell my girls, "good things can come out of something like this. Maybe you three will grow closer during this time together." They stare at me like I'm insane. I tell them how their Uncle Patrick and I bonded back in 1980 over the volcano, how we gathered up ash and stored it in Coke bottles and chewing tobacco tins, how we had plans to sell it to tourists. I tell them how, the night of the eruption, I invited Patrick to sleep in my room because he was so scared. How we got bunk beds and shared a room for 2 years until his mother got well enough to take him back. "Wait, what?" says the 16-year-old. Patrick lives with his wife and son in Nevada now. He works at an auto body shop. My kids met him on our drive to Disneyland 2 years ago. I realize by the looks they're giving me now that they didn't know the family history. They just know him as Uncle Patrick. "Grandma's not Uncle Patrick's mother?" asks the 13-year-old. "That's not the point," I say. "What I'm saying is that you never know what will pull people together." "Let's go back to Grandpa's baby mama," says the 16-year-old. "No offense to your dirt collection, but I'd rather hear about that." So I tell them everything, even the waffle stompers. It only lasted a day, my supervillain period. Patrick's teacher called my mom, and when I got home from school, she was waiting, seething, shuddering. She grabbed me by the arm and dragged me outside. "What?" I said. "Don't speak," she said. She climbed in her car, a green AMC Gremlin. I got in the passenger side, indignant, arms crossed. "What?" I said again. "Be quiet," she said. She was barely keeping it together. She drove us downtown, silent the whole way, and finally parked across from a brick apartment building. "That's where Patrick and his mom lived," she said, "on the third floor. They had one room and a shared bathroom down the hall. Patrick's mother was depressed and stopped sending Patrick to school. Then he got caught shoplifting potato chips from that store." She pointed to a newsstand across the street, PM Jacoy's. "When the police brought him home, they found him living in squalor, his mom catatonic on the couch. He'd been taking care of her." I felt the first stirrings of shame rumbling my core like an earthquake. That's when Mom's calm melted away and she grabbed my arm. "I am not going to let this turn you into an asshole, Tony." Tears spilled over her cheeks. "Listen, in your life there will be disappointments, struggles, regrets. People will let you down, make you angry. They will not live the way you want them to. And you have a choice, to live with empathy or live with resentment. That's it. But know this, if you choose resentment, you will break my heart. Do you understand me?" I did, instantly. I could see it in her face. Empathy. I imagine being the kind of person who would take in the kid that your son of a bitch husband had with some other woman. How hard that must be. And yet she did it, without complaint or congratulations. She did it because it was right. My shame erupted, and I began crying too. I sat with Mom and that little green gremlin, and we wept together. Okay, she said finally. Then she squeezed my arm, started the car, and drove us home. And somehow, she still had dinner on the table at 6.
That was Jess Walter, reading his short story, What Rises Beneath, first published in the Spokesman Review newspaper as part of their 2020 Summer Stories fiction series. Many thanks to the authors and readers who contributed to this presentation of this year's Summer Stories, and to Carolyn Lamberson and the Spokesman Review. You can listen back to all 16 short stories featured here on The Bookshelf by subscribing to The Bookshelf in your podcast app or at SpokanePublicRadio.org. You can also read the full Summer Stories series at Spokesman.com. For The Bookshelf and Spokane Public Radio, I'm Chris Messini.